fired, 16 on the courthouse square, another 16 over the Potomac. In Richmond, there were fireworks, and in Pennsylvania, Republicans rang bells from before noon to sundown. Our people in this county are running perfectly mad with enthusiasm about the man of the people, the savior of his country, as they term him, said a New York Federalist. Drunken frolics are the order of the day, and more bullocks and rams are sacrificed to this newfangled deity than were formerly by the Israelitish priests. An evangelical minister, William Scales, took a more optimistic view. Many declare you an atheist, Scales wrote to Jefferson. But be it so, I much rather a liberal atheist should govern the people than a bigoted saint who knows not God. John Marshall, serving concurrently as Secretary of State and as Chief Justice until Jefferson took office, looked on with wonder and anxiety. He declined to speculate on the causes of what he thought the strange revolution which has taken place in public opinion in replacing Adams with Jefferson. The course to be pursued is of more importance, and is not easily to be determined by those who have no place in the confidence of the president-elect, Marshall wrote Rufus King. On foreign policy, Marshall shared the old Federalist fear that Jefferson would excite the resentment and hate of the people against England, but without designing to proceed to actual hostilities. For all the strife of recent years, Jefferson and the Adamses had managed to maintain quietly civil relations. In early January 1801, the President and the First Lady asked the Vice President to dinner. "Mr. Jefferson dines with us," and in a card reply to the President's invitation, he begs him to be assured of his homage and high consideration, Abigail wrote one of her sons on Saturday, January 3, 1801. She was to leave Washington on Friday, February 13th. Before she departed, she received Jefferson for tea. As Abigail told it, "Jefferson made me a visit in order to take leave and wish me a good journey. It was more than I expected." Such small human moments speak well of both the Adamses and of Jefferson. They had been through so much together. Few others alive could have understood as well or as thoroughly what their lives had been like in the previous quarter century or so. Politics had brought them together, and politics had now driven them apart. And yet they still found it in themselves to treat one another with outward grace. Jefferson quietly exulted at the outcome of the election. "I cannot regret entirely the disappointment of not meeting Polly and yourself at Monticello because of the cause, which must be a subject of pleasure to us all," he wrote Patsy of his new need to be in Washington. He liked that his victory was seen in global terms. "As to the future, thou art to be the principal actor," wrote his revolutionary colleague John Dickinson. "Perhaps we are the selected people upon earth, from whom large portions of mankind are to learn that liberty is really a transcendent blessing, as capable by its enlightened energies of calmly dissipating its internal enemies, as of triumphantly repelling its foreign foes." Another admirer wrote Jefferson, "To you, sir, doth the groaning Republicans over the world look up to for relief." Jefferson did not let such talk inflate his expectations. "If we spend any in hypothetical discussions," he said, "we shall want time for real business." He knew what he needed to do. "The duty of the chief magistrate," Jefferson once said, "was to unite in himself the confidence of the whole people, to produce a union of the powers of the whole, and point them in a single direction, as if all constituted but one body and one mind." And he knew how hard all of that was. "I sincerely thank you for your congratulations on my election, but this is only the first verse of the chapter," he wrote his friend John Page. "What the last may be, nobody can tell." Part 8. The President of the United States, 1801 to 1809. All will bear in mind this sacred principle, that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must be reasonable, that the minority possess their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite with one heart and one mind. Thomas Jefferson, in his first inaugural address, March 4, 1801. Chapter 32. The New Order of Things Begins. You always had the people, and now have the government on your side, so that the prospect is as favorable as could be wished. At the same time, it must be admitted, you have much trouble and difficulty to encounter. James Monroe. I know indeed there are monarchists among us. Thomas Jefferson. It was not the warmest of exchanges. To make arrangements for the inaugural, Jefferson had to write his cousin, John Marshall, the Federalist whom John Adams had named Chief Justice, and who only days before had been a possible rival of Jefferson's for the presidency. As the two houses have notice of the hour, I presume a precise punctuality to it will be expected from me, Jefferson wrote. Marshall replied that he would make a point of being punctual. Both men were on time. As noon approached on Wednesday, March 4, 1801, President-elect Thomas Jefferson prepared to make the short walk from Conrad and McMunn's to the Capitol. John Adams was not present. The second president had made plans to leave Washington on the 4 a.m. stage, heading north toward home. He went through New York, it was said, like a shot. Sensible, moderate men of both parties would have been pleased had he tarried until after the installation of his successor, wrote the Massachusetts spy. It certainly would have had good effect. Yet Adams was still grieving over the death in November 1800 of his son Charles, and with Abigail awaiting him at home in Massachusetts, he was more than ready to leave the capital. Though he was to live another quarter of a century, Adams never returned to Washington. On Capitol Hill, cannon fire sounded outside Jefferson's boarding house. It was a salute from the District of Columbia's Artillery Corps. At one point in the morning hours, Samuel Harrison Smith called on Jefferson to pick up a package, a copy of the inaugural address, written in Jefferson's small, neat hand, to be set in type and published in the National Intelligencer. At 10 o'clock, a company of riflemen from Alexandria, Virginia, had arrived to form a small parade. Shortly before noon, Jefferson stepped outside to meet a detachment of militia officers that escorted him to the inaugural ceremonies. A delegation of congressmen joined him, and the politicians followed a group of officers to the Capitol. Their swords drawn, the militiamen parted to allow Jefferson through and stood saluting as he passed by. After another blast of cannon rang out, echoing across the hilltop village, Jefferson went inside the Capitol building. About 1,000 people awaited him in the Senate chamber, a room one lawmaker described in a letter home to his wife as magnificent in height and decorated in a grand style. The room was 86 by 48 feet, the ceiling 41 feet high. Each senator had a desk and a red leather chair. Margaret Bayard Smith wrote that it was so crowded that I believe not another creature could enter. Members of the House and the Senate rose in deference to Jefferson as he made his way to the well of the room. After Marshall administered the oath of office, Thomas Jefferson delivered his inaugural address. In his weak voice, few in the crowded room could hear him distinctly, he read one of the most significant state papers in American history, a brief for freedom and forbearance. All will bear in mind this sacred principle, that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will, to be rightful, must be reasonable, that the minority possesses their equal rights, which equal law must protect, and to violate would be oppression. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite with one heart and one mind. Let us restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this Union or to change its Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. I know indeed that some honest men fear that a Republican government cannot be strong, that this government is not strong enough. But would the honest patriot, in the full tide of successful experiment, abandon a government which has so far kept us free and firm on the theoretic and visionary fear that this government, the world's best hope, may by possibility want energy to preserve itself? I trust not. I believe this, on the contrary, the strongest government on earth. I believe it the only one where every man, at the call of the law, would fly to the standard of the law, and would meet invasions of the public order as his own personal concern. Sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others? Or have we found angels in the forms of kings to govern him? Let history answer this question. I repair, then, fellow citizens, to the post you have assigned me. With experience enough in subordinate offices to have seen the difficulties of this, the greatest of all, I have learnt to expect that it will rarely fall to the lot of imperfect man to retire from this station with the reputation and the favor which bring him into it. I shall often go wrong through defect of judgment. When right, I shall often be thought wrong by those whose positions will not command a view of the whole ground. I ask your indulgence for my own errors, which will never be intentional, and your support against the errors of others, who may condemn what they would not if seen in all its parts. The address was a political masterpiece. Today the new political year commences. The new order of things begins, John Marshall wrote Charles Cotesworth Pinckney in the moments before the inauguration, adding, "The Democrats are divided into speculative theorists and absolute terrorists." With the latter, I am not disposed to class Mr. Jefferson. Still, if he arranges himself with them, it is not difficult to foresee that much calamity is in store for our country. If he does not, they will soon become his enemies and calumniators. Returning to his letter-writing at 4 p.m., Marshall was slightly cheerier. "You will, before this reaches you, see his inauguration speech," Marshall wrote. "It is, in the general, well-judged and conciliatory. James Bayard thought it, in political substance, better than we expected, and not answerable to the expectations of the partisans of the other side. Hamilton admitted that it was virtually a candid retraction of past misapprehensions, and a pledge to the community that the new president will not lend himself to dangerous innovations, but in essential points will tread in the steps of his predecessors. To Benjamin Rush, the physician and Jefferson admirer, it was an occasion for thanksgiving. Old friends who had been separated by party names and a supposed difference of principle in politics for many years shook hands with each other immediately after reading it, and discovered for the first time that they had differed in opinion only about the best means of promoting the interests of their common country. In his personal grief, John Adams wrote Jefferson from Quincy, Massachusetts, about his dead son. "It is not possible that anything of the kind should happen to you, and I sincerely wish you may never experience anything in any degree resembling it." Then Adams added a gracious political note. "This part of the Union is in a state of perfect tranquility, and I see nothing to obscure your prospect of a quiet and prosperous administration, which I heartily wish you." Jefferson was eager to wield the power he had long sought. "We reflect that it is according to nature for the strongest to bear the burden," Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. wrote to Jefferson, "and we know well that your mind does from nature exult in grand scenes, in ample fields for exertion, in extraordinary toils." He was to spend his presidential years, he said, "pursuing steadily my object of proving that a people, easy in their circumstances as ours are capable of conducting themselves under a government founded not in the fears and follies of man, but on his reason. This is the object now nearest to my heart." Jefferson privately acknowledged the burdens he faced. "I feel a great load of public favor and of public expectation," he wrote the day after the inauguration. "More confidence is placed in me than my qualifications merit, and I dread the disappointment of my friends." Whether seeking the approval of his father, his mother, his teachers, his contemporaries, or his countrymen. Jefferson had moved through life at once exhilarated and exhausted by the role of patriarch. Raised to be responsible for the lives and welfare of others, he knew nothing else. He had thought much about human nature and human government, and he believed it his duty to bring what in his inaugural he had called harmony and affection to the life of the American nation. From war-making to economic life to territorial acquisition to federal spending to subpoenas and the sharing of information with Congress and the courts, Jefferson maintained or expanded the authority of the presidential office. He was fortunate to preside over Republican congressional majorities. The Senate margin grew from a narrow 17 Republicans to 15 Federalists in 1801-1803 to 28-6 by Jefferson's last year in office. The Republican rhetoric of limited and minimal government was heartfelt but hardly controlling. Jefferson had reached the pinnacle by articulating the ideal but acting pragmatically. He could have resigned the vice presidency to protest the Alien and Sedition Acts, for instance. He had, instead, preserved his position in the existing political order, awaiting the hour when he might ascend to the summit. As president, he fully intended to rule in the way he had risen. The story of his two terms in the president's house is one of a lifelong student of control and power, bringing all of his virtues and vices to the largest possible stage. Federalists, who expected him to begin the world over again by seeking to minimize the executive office, misjudged him. Critics of Jefferson have argued that his vision of an agrarian nation with a weak central government puts him on the wrong side of history. It was Hamilton, they say, who correctly anticipated a future that would require a system of capital and large-scale action to create the means of national greatness. This critique of Jefferson, while familiar, is incomplete. Jefferson sent a reassuring signal to the manufacturing and financial interests who had learned to fear him as a champion of the agrarian over the commercial. One imputation in particular has been repeated till it seems as if some at least believed it, that I am an enemy to commerce, Jefferson wrote a correspondent on Wednesday, February 18, 1801. They admit me a friend to agriculture, and suppose me an enemy to the only means of disposing of its produce. The presidency Jefferson left in 1809 was rich in precedent for vigorous, decisive, and often unilateral action. It is not too much to say that Jefferson used Hamiltonian means to pursue Jeffersonian ends. He embraced ultimate power subtly, but surely. Open political warfare was not for him. He preferred to impress himself on the course of events without bombast or drama, leading so quietly that popular history tends to make too little of his achievements as president. He understood the country was open to, even eager, for a government that seemed less intrusive and overbearing than the one Washington and Adams had created. In his 8 years in office, Jefferson brought the national debt down from $83 million to $57 million. He cut taxes and spending. In a new time of peace, the quasi-war ended 6 months before his inauguration, Jefferson reduced military spending to pre-war levels and downsized the Navy to 13 frigates. For the moment, he believed, it was impossible for the United States to attempt to rival the naval powers of Europe. His maritime strategy was one of defense, except in regard to the Barbary pirates, whom he continued to pursue and combat. Jefferson had long cared about two things, American liberty and American strength. For 8 years he summoned all the powers he believed he required to make America more like what he thought it should be. In the partisan wars of the 1790s, many of his foes had misinterpreted his disposition toward individual freedom rather than toward Hamiltonian authority as dreaminess and weakness. They would learn, quickly and unmistakably, that they were wrong. The outward reformation of Federalist America began on the morning of the inauguration, when Jefferson declined to wear a ceremonial sword to the swearing-in, breaking tradition with Washington and Adams. After the solemnities, Jefferson took his dinner, as usual, at Conrad and McMunn's. he soon sold President Adams's coaches and silver harnesses, another symbolic strike against Federalist trappings. The Adamses had moved into the president's house on the first day of November 1800. Abigail Adams hung laundry in the East Room, which Mrs. Adams had called the Great Unfinished Audience Room. Jefferson now installed his secretary, Meriwether Lewis, there. For his own office, the president took a room in the southwest corner of the first floor, looking out toward the Potomac. There was a table with drawers for Jefferson's tools and knick-knacks. He kept geraniums in the window and mockingbirds at hand. He liked quiet, but could not stand silence. He was usually humming or singing softly to himself, and from the early 1770s forward, Jefferson kept pet mockingbirds. He cherished the birds for their music, and in hours of contemplative leisure he sometimes opened their cage to allow them to flit about his private suite at Monticello or his president's house office. Jefferson bought his first bird from a slave of his father-in-law, John Wales, in Charles City County in November 1772. It took another 20 years for mockingbirds to reach Monticello, naturally. Learn all the children to venerate it as a superior being in the form of a bird, or as a being which will haunt them if any harm is done to itself or its eggs, Jefferson wrote home when he learned of the mockingbird's arrival on the mountaintop. As president, Jefferson kept a bird he named Dick hanging in its cage in the window in his office amid geraniums and roses. According to Margaret Bayard Smith, Dick was the constant companion of his solitary and studious hours, sometimes settling on Jefferson's shoulder or accepting food from his lips. Often when he retired to his chamber, it would hop up the stairs after him while he took his siesta, would sit on his couch and pour forth its melodious strains. As Jefferson took over the presidential mansion, he ordered the demolition of an existing wooden privy on the lawn and had the parts for water closets of superior construction sent from Philadelphia. Accustomed to mastery at Monticello, Jefferson sought to establish the same dynamic at the president's house. He decided which pieces of furniture should stay and which should go. The room Adams had used for levees, the modern state dining room, was the one he had chosen for his working office, and an oval room on the first floor, the modern blue room, was made into a drawing room. He ordered the hanging of household bells in the mansion so that he could summon servants at will, a convenience contemplated by the Adamses but completed by Jefferson in his first months. His chief domestic, Rapin, kept Jefferson informed about the progress of renovations and construction. Etienne Lemaire soon became Jefferson's major domo in Washington. The members of his cabinet represented the major regions of the country. James Madison of Virginia was appointed Secretary of State. Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania accepted the Treasury Department. Henry Dearborn from Massachusetts became Secretary of War. Levi Lincoln of Massachusetts was to be Attorney General. Robert Smith of Maryland became Secretary of the Navy. The appointment of Gallatin was one of the shrewdest. Born in Geneva in 1761, Gallatin came to the United States in 1780, served in the Revolution, taught French at Harvard, mastered finance, and held a variety of elective posts, including, briefly, the Senate seat, from which he was ejected in 1794 for failing to meet the citizenship requirement. He was a key Republican leader in the House of Representatives during the years of the Alien and Sedition Acts and the Quasi-War with France from 1798 to 1800. Gallatin and his second wife, Hannah, got along well with Jefferson, who trusted Gallatin's financial and political counsel. He would serve as Secretary of the Treasury from 1801 until 1814. Listing the Republican gains in Congress and in the states, the French diplomat Louis-André Pichon told Paris that Jefferson stood at a remarkable pinnacle. The fall of the Federalists from their seeming invincibility during the fever of the Quasi-War was striking. One cannot help, Pichon said, but be astonished by its rapidity. Even New England was not immune to the rise of the Republicans. Henceforth, we can predict that Mr. Jefferson will have only a weak opposition, Pichon wrote, noting that the expansion of Western populations would only add to Jefferson's power, since such people would be invariably opposed to the cities on the coast. In Jefferson's enthusiasm, the new president fell back on his favored nautical imagery. "The storm through which we have passed has been tremendous indeed," Jefferson wrote John Dickinson 2 days after the inauguration. "The tough sides of our Argosy have been thoroughly tried. Her strength has stood the waves into which she was steered with a view to sink her. We shall put her on her Republican tack, and she will now show by the beauty of her motion the skill of her builders." To the English scientist and theologian Joseph Priestley, he allowed his historical imagination to take flight. "We can no longer say there is nothing new under the sun, for this whole chapter in the history of man is new. The great extent of our republic is new. Its sparse habitation is new. The mighty wave of public opinion which has rolled over it is new." Such was the idealistic Jefferson. But he was also realistic. "I am sensible how far I should fall short of effecting all the reformation which reason would suggest and experience approve, were I free to do whatever I thought best," he wrote. "But when we reflect how difficult it is to move or inflect the great machine of society, how impossible to advance the notions of a whole people suddenly to ideal right, we see the wisdom of Solon's remark that no more good must be attempted than the nation can bear. And that will be chiefly to reform the waste of public money, and thus drive away the vultures who prey on it, and improve some little on old routines." Even more bluntly and vividly, Jefferson referred to the Federalists as madmen. "Their leaders are a hospital of incurables, and as such entitled to be protected and taken care of, as other insane persons are." Still, there was hope, for to Jefferson, where there was freedom, there was always hope. "The times have been awful," he said, "but they have proved a useful truth, that the good citizen must never despair of the Commonwealth." Priestley hoped, too, that politics will not make you forget what is due to science. Jefferson, in fact, saw them as connected. A politics of personal liberty created a sense of free inquiry. A man liberated from monarchical or hereditary limitations stood a greater chance of possessing a mind free to roam and to grow, and to create and to innovate in a climate in which citizens live together in essential harmony and affection. This was Jefferson's ideal republic, and he was committed to making it real. He did not lack for advice on how to govern in the wake of the narrow decisions in the House. "Many friends may grow cool from disappointment," wrote James Monroe. "The violent who have their passions too much excited will experience mortification in not finding them fully gratified. In addition, the discomfited Tory party, profiting of past divisions and follies, which have contributed much to overwhelm them, will reunite their scattered force against us. It will intrigue with foreign powers, and therefore ought to be watched." Tench Coxe issued a warning. "The dangers to our form of government at home and abroad yet exist," he wrote Jefferson. According to Virginia's William Branch Giles, "the ejected party is now almost universally considered as having been employed in conjunction with Great Britain in a scheme for the total destruction of the liberties of the people." On any given day, Jefferson dealt with a range of issues and problems from his office on the first floor of the presidential mansion. Appointments to office, politics in New England, the Barbary Coast, agricultural policy, the West Indies, French and English diplomacy. Paper flowed in and out of Jefferson's hands. Neither Patsy nor Polly came to live with him in Washington, nor is there any record that Sally Hemings ever left Albemarle County to visit the president's house. A social creature, Jefferson nevertheless lived in relative domestic isolation in Washington. Only Meriwether Lewis kept house with him in the unfinished mansion. Jefferson said that they lived like two mice in a church. He felt lonely early in his tenure. His colleagues were slow to assemble. "I am still at a great loss," he said as he settled in. "Neither the James Madisons nor the Albert Gallatins were yet in residence in the Capitol. When the Gallatins arrived, they received a blanket invitation from Jefferson, who asked them to dine every day. It would," he said, "be a real favor." But he was disappointed when the Gallatins decided to move farther away from the president's house. The city is rather sickly. My family has their share, and they are extremely anxious on that account to move on Capitol Hill," Gallatin wrote Jefferson in August. The Treasury Secretary was quick to reassure the President that he would remain nearby. It is substituting precisely 20 minutes' ride to 10. Unlike many of his fellow officials and lawmakers, Jefferson liked the new capital city. "We find this a very agreeable country residence," he wrote. "Good society, and enough of it, and free from the noise, the heat, the stench, and the bustle of a close-built town." Building a new American future required redeeming the excesses of the Federalist past, and Jefferson issued presidential pardons for some of the printers convicted under the Sedition Act. The case of his old ally James Thompson Callender, who had been convicted, fined, and imprisoned, was the most personal for him. Callender's pardon was dated Monday, March 16, 1801. Callender had three children to support and wanted his $200 fine to the government refunded. It was not forthcoming, and by Sunday, April 12, 1801, Callender was hurt by the disappointment of not having his fine repaid. "I now begin to know what ingratitude is," he said. Jefferson wanted to keep the Republican version of reality alive in the minds of the people. On Friday, March 20, 1801, he asked Albert Gallatin to reply to a circular letter by the Federalist Robert Goodloe Harper that extolled the virtues of the Washington Adams years. "It was," Jefferson said, "a false and frivolous account, and the other side of the medal requires to be shown." In a sign of good care, Jefferson did not put his name to the request. Orchestrating Republican writings from behind the scenes was nothing new for Jefferson, and it is revealing that he turned to Gallatin now that the administration had commenced. Callender, whom Jefferson had patronized in years gone by, had been out of favor since 1800. Why did Jefferson turn on Callender? Part of the reason may lie in a recurring feature of American politics, a successful president's discomfort with the less respectable men and means that got him to victory. There is usually a moment in the life of a new president when he begins to see himself not as an aspirant desperate to win, but as a statesman above the squalor and the sweat of actual vote-getting. Rising men do not like to be reminded of the smell of the stables. Dignitaries dislike recollections of the dust through which they have come. The polemicist had been useful on the journey, but there was apparently no place for his acidic attacks now that the popular votes were cast and his machinations had been put on display at trial. In Callender, in the pursuit of power, Jefferson made a devil's bargain. He supported and consorted with a man skilled in the dark arts of partisan warfare, but he seems not to have considered that the same man might one day turn on him. When repayment for the fine was not forthcoming, Callender told Madison, "Mr. Jefferson has not returned one shilling of my fine. I am not a man who is either to be oppressed or plundered with impunity." Callender decided that the fine was important, but perhaps a sinecure as postmaster of Richmond would be even better. Traveling to Washington, he met with Madison. The money was refused with cold disdain, which is quite as provoking as direct insolence, Callender wrote. Little Madison exerted a great deal of eloquence to show that it would be improper to repay the money at Washington. There were many factors at work. "Do you know that besides his other passions he is under the tyranny of that of love?" Madison asked Monroe. "The object of his flame is in Richmond. I did not ask her name, but presume her to be young and beautiful, in his eyes at least, and in a sphere above him. He has flattered himself into a persuasion that the emoluments and reputation of a post office would obtain her in marriage. Of these recommendations, however, he is sent back in despair." Madison also briefed the president, who dispatched Meriwether Lewis to give Callender $50 to tide him over until the fine could be repaid in full. Callender's attitude toward Lewis suggested that Jefferson might well have a larger problem on his hands than he realized. "His language to Captain Lewis was very high-toned," Jefferson wrote Monroe. "He intimated that he was in possession of things which he could and would use of a certain case, that he received the $50 not as charity but as a due, in fact, as hush money, that I knew what he expected, viz., a certain office, and more to this effect. Angry and hurt, Callender awaited the hour of vengeance. In the president's house, Jefferson craved control. In November 1801, he sent a note to his cabinet about how his government was to work, and as usual, with questions of process, it was a document about power. Jefferson wanted to be in on every detail, and he framed his approach to the public business in terms of following President Washington's precedent. Nearly all letters of business had passed through Washington's hands. By this means, Jefferson told his own cabinet, President Washington was always in accurate possession of all facts and proceedings in every part of the Union, and to whatsoever department they related, Jefferson said. This was how Jefferson wanted things too. He felt, he said, a sense of obligation imposed on me by the public will to meet personally the duties to which they have appointed me. And so it would be. He looked forward to intelligence of any kind, telling Gallatin that papers conveying information of what is passing or of the state of things are desirable. He wanted to know everything. He had to know everything. Chapter 33. A Confident President. The measures recommended by the president are all popular in all parts of the nation. John Quincy Adams. Here are so many wants, so many affections and passions engaged, so varying in their interests and objects, that no one can be conciliated without revolting others. Thomas Jefferson, on the Political Culture of Washington, D.C. By mid-November 1801, the presidency settled into what Jefferson called a steady and uniform course. He worked from 10 to 13 hours a day at his writing table, doing paperwork and receiving callers from early morning until midday. That gave him, he figured, an interval of 4 hours for riding, dining, and a little unbending. At noon, he tried to leave the president's house for a ride or a walk before returning to be engaged with company till candlelight. It was only at night, and it was the rare night, that he spent time on the mechanics, mathematics, philosophy, etc., that he loved. Jefferson was keen about his privacy. He was glad to see one particular servant at the president's house go. I had good reason to believe he read the papers which happened to be on my table whenever I went out of my cabinet, and it was impossible for me to lock them up every time I stepped out of the room. Jefferson's hours were vulnerable. On one occasion, he had to move quickly to quell some tension with a supporter. Some enemy, whom we know not, is sowing tares among us, Jefferson wrote Nathaniel Macon, the Republican Speaker of the House from North Carolina. There was nothing to it, Jefferson said, but they should talk things over. This evening my company may perhaps stay late, but tomorrow evening or the next I can be alone, he told Macon. On the eve of each congressional session, he held engagements with friends whom he knew he would not see again until the lawmakers left Washington. As Congress will meet this day week, we begin now to be in the bustle of preparation. I am this week getting through the dining all my friends of this place to be ready for the congressional campaign, he wrote his granddaughter, Ellen Wales Randolph Coolidge. When that begins, between the occupations of business and of entertainment, I shall become an unpunctual correspondent. One such friend was Margaret Bayard Smith, who, with her husband, Samuel Harrison Smith, grew close to Jefferson and to Dolly and James Madison in these years. The Madisons stayed briefly with Jefferson in the president's house before setting up their own home, first on Pennsylvania Avenue, 4 blocks toward Georgetown, and then settling at 1333 F Street. There, Dolly established a hospitable salon within their 3-story brick house. Her dining room and parlors were full of politics and what she called fashionable talk, and the occasional game of cards. She was fond of gambling. In May 1801, with the gathering of the cabinet, Mrs. Smith said the Capitol was as gay as in the winter. The arrival of all the secretaries seems to give new animation to business, and the settlements of their families affords employment to some of our tradesmen. At a small dinner in the president's house with the Madisons, Mrs. Smith sat next to Jefferson and was entranced anew by his easy, candid, and gentle manners. Watching the president and James Madison in the drawing room later, Mrs. Smith thought the two were so easy and familiar that they produced no restraint. The Gallatins were also familiar faces in the president's circle. They decided to live on M Street near 32nd, and Mrs. Gallatin was a congenial, if less than beautiful, woman. Her person is far less attractive than either her mind or her heart, yet I do not wish her to have any other than that which she has got, Albert Gallatin had candidly written of his wife at the time of their marriage. Her understanding is good. She is as well informed as most young ladies. She is perfectly simple and unaffected. She loves me, and she is a pretty good Democrat. Jefferson governed personally. He knew no other way. He had watched Peyton Randolph lead the House of Burgesses, sometimes in meetings in Randolph's deep-red clabbered house at Nicholson and North England Streets in Williamsburg. From his time spent in the Confederation Congress and presiding over the Senate for 4 years as vice president, Jefferson appreciated how to handle lawmakers, for he had long been one. Even then, a president's attentions meant the world to politicians and ordinary people alike. For all his low-key Republican symbolism, Jefferson understood that access to the president himself could make all the difference in statecraft. Hence, his dinners with lawmakers and his willingness to receive callers. The strategy worked. In the Jefferson years, Republicans were heard to acknowledge that the president's dinners had silenced them at moments when they were inclined to vote against the administration. He believed in constant conversation between the president and lawmakers, for Jefferson thought that if the members are to know nothing but what is important enough to be put into a public message, it becomes a government of chance and not of design. The president had to be able to trust lawmakers with insights and opinions that he might not offer a broader audience, creating a sense of intimacy and common purpose. Making speeches at other politicians, or appearing to be only making speeches at them, was not the best way to enlist their allegiance or their aid, nor to govern well. Jefferson preferred to project power without being showy about it. "What sort of government is that of the U.S.?" Napoleon once asked a French traveler who had just returned from spending time with President Jefferson. "One, sire," the traveler said, "that is neither seen or felt." That was precisely what Jefferson wanted the world to think. Another caller in the president's house, the European naturalist Alexander von Humboldt, visited Jefferson in the cabinet room. Observing that a ferociously negative Federalist newspaper was lying about here at the center of Republican power, Baron Humboldt asked Jefferson, "Why are these libels allowed? Why is not this libelous journal suppressed, or its editor at least fined and imprisoned?" The question gave Jefferson a perfect opening. "Put that paper in your pocket, Baron, and should you hear the reality of our liberty, the freedom of our press, questioned, show this paper and tell where you found it." President Washington had consciously cut a formal figure. President Jefferson received morning and mid-afternoon callers as though he had just, as he sometimes had, come in from a ride. "Mr. Jefferson has put aside all showing off. He greets guests in slovenly clothes and without the least formality," Louis-André Pichon wrote Paris in 1802. "He leaves every day on foot or on horseback, the most often on horseback, and without even being accompanied by a servant." Jefferson knew who he was, and he knew his place in the world. So he had nothing to prove by constantly appearing perfectly turned out. Quite the opposite. Often only the well-born or the socially serene can forego badges of status, the neglect or absence of which is in itself a badge of status. Jefferson wore different combinations of old frock coats, velveteen breeches, yarn stockings, and ancient slippers. When the British diplomat Augustus J. Foster was presented to Jefferson, Foster found that the president behaved very civilly in general. In the president's house, the door opened suddenly, and there was Jefferson. "He thrust out his hand to me, as he does to everybody, and desired me to sit down," Foster wrote his mother. "Luckily for me, I have been in Turkey and am quite at home in this primeval simplicity of manners." Foster was surprised at Jefferson's appearance. "He is dressed and looks extremely like a very plain farmer," and wears his slippers down at his heels," Foster wrote home. Unlike Foster, Joseph Story of Massachusetts, a lawyer and legislator who went on the Supreme Court in 1811, understood what Jefferson was doing. The man who obsessed over Europe's view of the taste and culture of America was not a provincial slob. He was, rather, who he was. "You know, Virginians have some pride in appearing in simple habiliments," wrote Story, "and are willing to rest their claim to attention upon their force of mind and suavity of manners." Edward Thornton, another British diplomat, shared Story's sense of things. "Jefferson may have been attracted by the leveling spirit of republicanism," Thornton wrote in a dispatch home, "but none of it was evident in the president's house, which was far better arranged than in the time of Mr. Adams, or in the economy of his household and in the style of his living, which are upon a more expansive scale than during the administrations of either of the former presidents, but with less of form and ostentation than was observed by General Washington." Jefferson's confidence in himself and his leadership was unmistakable. He believed the results of the 1800 election were a mandate for change, and while he usually exercised his power quietly, he did exercise it, keeping himself in command of the executive branch and making his wishes known to his allies in Congress. John Quincy Adams believed Jefferson's whole system of administration seems founded upon this principle of carrying through the legislature measures by his personal or official influence. Jefferson tended to get his way, as he had for so long, by smoothly but definitively bending the world to his will as much as he could. He was more of a chess player than a traditional warrior, thinking out his moves and executing them subtly, rather than reacting to events viscerally and showily. In Washington, in fact, he found himself in need of a book he had left at Monticello, a work of strategy by the chess master François-André Danican-Philidor. It was important enough to him that he recalled its place precisely. "You will find it in the book room, second press on the left from the door of the entrance," he wrote Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. At a cabinet meeting in the middle of May, 1801, Jefferson and his advisers debated the Barbary States. At issue was whether the United States ought to dispatch a squadron under Commodore Richard Dale to the Mediterranean, in a display of power, to discourage further piracy against American shipping. "All concur in the expediency of the cruise," Jefferson noted. He wanted to make sure they concurred in something else, too, that the naval forces were authorized, by executive, not legislative, authority, to search for and destroy the enemy's vessels wherever they can find them. Should Dale find that any of the Barbary States had declared war on the United States, he was to place his ships in a situation to chastise them. Should he find that all of them had declared war, he was told to distribute his force in such a manner so as best to protect our commerce and chastise their insolence, by sinking, burning, or destroying their ships and vessels wherever you shall find them. On Saturday, August 1, 1801, Andrew Sterrett of the Enterprise, who was serving under Dale, defeated the Tripolitan vessel Tripoli near Malta. "Too long have those barbarians been suffered to trample on the sacred faith of treaties, on the rights and laws of human nature," Jefferson told Sterrett. "You have shown to your countrymen that that enemy cannot meet bravery and skill united." Sterrett hobbled the Barbary ship and let it loose, continuing on his way. In the wake of the episode, Jefferson described the American victory and asked Congress to authorize offensive actions against aggressors in the Mediterranean. Yet he had clearly already provided such authority without Congress back in the spring. Sterrett had been acting under those orders. Here, Jefferson was effectively exerting control over military and foreign policy while appearing to defer to the legislature. It was typical Jefferson, having his way without precipitating confrontation or a distracting crisis. Congress fell into Jefferson's hands, essentially retroactively approving the orders to Dale and granting the president even wider authority in the wake of the Sterrett action. The executive, Congress declared, was to cause to be done all such other acts of precaution or hostility as the state of war will justify, and may, in his opinion, require. Under this provision, Jefferson attempted an elaborate operation to replace the Pasha of Tripoli, who had assassinated his own father and a brother, with a more compliant brother, Hamet, who had escaped to Tunis. Over the next several years, the Americans unsuccessfully attempted to effect a military overthrow of the regime in Tripoli in Hamet's favor, an undertaking that had grown out of Jefferson's initial unilateral projection of power in the region. The man who had, as Secretary of State, argued against broad construction in the case of the establishment of the Bank of the United States, found that his own powers as president benefited from the broadest kind of construction. Meriwether Lewis rode up Capitol Hill from the president's house. It was Tuesday, December 8, 1801, and Lewis, as the president's private secretary, was slated to carry Jefferson's first annual message to Congress. The world was largely at peace, Jefferson said, save for the Barbary States. He was reserved but steely, noting that he trusted the news of Sterrett's victory would be a testimony to the world that it is not a want of bravery which makes us seek their peace, but a conscientious desire to direct the energies of our nation to the multiplication of the human race, and not to its destruction. Jefferson's campaign to reduce federal taxes and spending, to suppress the new courts, and to allow the states to take the lead in determining the course of domestic affairs marked a significant turn from the basic direction of the country under Washington and Adams. The reaction to the president's message was warm. "Nothing can exceed our exultation on account of the president's message," said John Taylor of Caroline, "and nothing can exceed the depression of the monarchists." The Federalists were less enamored with the course of things. "Virginia literally dominates," Robert Troup wrote Rufus King in April 1802. "Jefferson is the supreme director of measures. He has no levee days, observes no ceremony, often sees company in an undress, sometimes with his slippers on, always accessible to and very familiar with the sovereign people." Connecticut Congressman Roger Griswold grasped the substance behind the Jeffersonian symbolism. After the annual message came to the Capitol, Griswold wrote, "Under this administration, nothing is to remain as it was. Every minutia is to be changed. When Mr. Adams was president, the door of the president's house opened to the east. Mr. Jefferson has closed that door and opened a new door to the west. General Washington and Mr. Adams opened every session of Congress with a speech. Mr. Jefferson delivers no speech, but makes his communication by a written message. I fear that you, aristocrats of New England, will think these important changes unnecessary and be apt to say that they are made with a view only to change, but you ought to recollect that you are neither philosophers or skilled in the mysteries of democratic policy." In the New York Evening Post, Alexander Hamilton wrote that Jefferson's message should alarm all who are anxious for the safety of our government, for the responsibility and welfare of our nation. His portrait of Jefferson was venomous and laced with envy and anger. "Mine is an odd destiny," Hamilton wrote Gouverneur Morris in these months. "Perhaps no man in the United States has sacrificed and done more for the present Constitution than myself, and I am still laboring to prop the frail and worthless fabric. What can I do better than withdraw from the scene? Every day proves to me more and more that this American world was not meant for me." The world did feel more Jeffersonian than Hamiltonian in the closing days of 1801. "Every day we see vanish the phantoms that the enemies of Mr. Jefferson had built up to discredit him," Pichon wrote to his superiors in Paris. One day a vast cheese arrived for the president from the people of Cheshire, Massachusetts. It was a curiosity that became an emblem of Republican tribute in the popular culture. "It is not the last stone in the Bastille, nor is it of any great consequence as an article of worth, but as a freewill offering, we hope it will be received," said the citizens of Cheshire. God and politics were on Jefferson's mind on New Year's Day, 1802. In Colebrook, Connecticut, in October 1801, the Danbury Baptist Association had assembled to applaud Jefferson's views on religious liberty. In reply, he offered a testament to freedom of conscience that unsettled his Federalist foes. "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. Benjamin Rush had helped inform Jefferson's views on church and state in 1800. "I agree with you likewise in your wishes to keep religion and government independent of each other," Rush had told Jefferson. "Were it possible for St. Paul to rise from his grave at the present juncture, he would say to the clergy who are now so active in settling the political affairs of the world, 'Cease from your political labors. Your kingdom is not of this world. Read my epistles. In no part of them will you perceive me aiming to depose a pagan emperor or to place a Christian upon a throne. Christianity disdains to receive support from human governments.'" Among Federalists, the contempt for Jefferson ran high. George Cabot of Massachusetts feared what he called the terrible evils of democracy, but believed Jefferson was unstoppable. The evidence of the winter and the spring of 1801-02 suggested Cabot's assessment of Jefferson's power was right. In these months, Jefferson convinced Congress to abolish all internal taxes, authorize military force against Tripoli, found the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, ease naturalization rules, and, perhaps most significantly, repeal the Judiciary Act of 1801, the law that had expanded federal jurisdiction and created additional courts and judgeships filled by Federalists before Adams left office. Told that the president was redesigning a set of medals intended as gifts for Indian tribes, former Secretary of War James McHenry took a wry tone. "Would to God that he had confined his revolutionary genius to things of no greater importance, we should have had less today to apprehend for the fate of the Constitution and our country." Beginning with the struggle in the House for the presidency, Aaron Burr had become a seemingly uncontrollable political actor in Jefferson's Republican Party. Partly because of the Republicans' belief that Burr had not energetically shut down Federalist efforts to use Burr to deny Jefferson victory in 1800-1801, and partly because of the complications of New York state politics, Burr represented just one faction. Jefferson chose to thwart Burr's ambitions once the presidential contest was settled. One Burrite, Matthew L. Davis, called on the president to plead his own case for a federal post. Hearing Davis out, Jefferson noticed a buzzing fly and deftly reached out and snatched it out of the air. The gesture was hardly reassuring to the visitor. A president quick enough and wily enough to snag a fly was unlikely to be moved in any direction he did not wish to move. Davis did not get the job, and the snub, Gallatin remarked, was seen as a snub of Burr. "There is hardly a man who meddles with politics in New York," Gallatin told Jefferson, "who does not believe that Davis's rejection is owing to Burr's recommendation." Hamilton shrewdly assessed the political tension between President Jefferson and Vice President Burr. "There is certainly a most serious schism between the chief and his heir apparent, a schism absolutely incurable, because founded in the breasts of both is the rivalship of an insatiable and unprincipled ambition," Hamilton wrote King in June 1802. "Mr. Burr will surely arrive at the presidency," wrote Louis-André Pichon. "Nobody conducts better than him a political intrigue." At a celebratory Federalist dinner in honor of George Washington's birthday in the Capitol in 1802, Burr arrived unexpectedly and cleverly asked whether he was an intruder. He was answered in the negative and treated with becoming civility, Troop reported to King. Burr bided his time a bit and then asked whether he might propose a toast. Given the floor, Burr raised a glass and said, "To the union of all honest men." The implication was clear to the gathering. This was generally received by the Federalists as an offer on his part to coalesce, Troop said. On Thursday, July 1, 1802, Republicans celebrated Jefferson's repeal of internal taxes. On the 4th of July, in Charleston, South Carolina, the Reverend Richard Furman linked the American Revolution to Jefferson's administration, arguing that the two events were divinely ordained. the special feasts and rejoicings on the 1st of July, and the toasts of the 4th of July, as they have been received from different quarters, prove that all Republicans are pleased with them. Pichon was privately critical of Jefferson's administration. The principles which direct it are evident. The party spirit has passion, an ambition which wants to conserve the power in pleasing the greatest number, a singular propensity to new ideas, and a childish vanity concealed under an exterior of simplicity. Pichon complained, too, of Jefferson's excluding him and his wife from an invitation extended to houseguests of the French envoy. "That would scarcely happen in a capital city," said Pichon. "It's appointed rudeness in this desert." The Federalists, though, realized the political facts. Jefferson is the idol to whom all devotion is paid, and Burr will doubtless be dropped at another election, if they can do it without endangering Jefferson, Troop wrote King in April 1802. Though he never went beyond Hot Springs, Virginia, Jefferson loved the West. 20 years before, he had proposed an expedition to be led by George Rogers Clark. A decade later, in 1793, Jefferson took the lead for the American Philosophical Society in planning an exploratory journey by the French botanist André Michaud. Neither the Clark mission nor the Michaud effort came to pass, and it finally took a threat from the British to press Jefferson and the United States into action. The anxiety was by now ancient, that the British, as well as the Spanish and the French and various Indian tribes, would establish or, depending on the circumstances, extend holdings in the New World to hem the United States in, thus limiting American growth and creating the constant possibility of invasion. The new occasion was the publication of the fur trader Alexander Mackenzie's book, Voyages from Montreal. Reading it in the summer of 1802, Jefferson was struck by Mackenzie's account of traveling through Canada and reaching the Pacific in 1793. Mackenzie wrote enthusiastically of the prospects for Britain in the farther reaches of North America, arguing, "It requires only the countenance and support of the British government to secure the trade of that country to its subjects." There was more. Many political reasons, presumably including the possible restoration of the power of the British Empire over its lost colonies, must present themselves to the mind of every man acquainted with the enlarged system and capacities of British commerce, Mackenzie had suggested. It was all connected to an old Jeffersonian fear, one he had articulated to George Rogers.